This is Haunted America Radio with your host, Al Shepard Sr. and Al Shepard Jr. on 1370 AM WBTN. To discuss tonight's topics, please give us a call at 802-442-1010. That's 802-442-1010. And now, Haunted America Radio with Al and Al.
And good evening, everyone, to this week's edition of Haunted America Radio here on 1370 AM WBTN. I want to give a shout out and say hello to everyone listening out on Knight Rider Radio as well. Thanks to Tony for carrying our show.
Knight Rider, what are they like? They chat about Kit.
No, he does have a picture of the Knight Rider car on his site, though. They are the, turbocharged mix music station, which is hillbilly for you don't never know what you're going to hear.
Cool. Sounds good to me.
Anyways, we are joined this week by, I don't even know where to start with a biography for Michael J. Baker. We had him on the show, I think it was episode 3, way back when. We were just starting out on the internet. He is the director of the paranormal documentary 14 Degrees and a whole bunch of other stuff. So, Michael, you with us?
I'm with you.
All right. Why don't you tell me what you want to be known for?
Well, I guess it depends on who you ask. But I started out with what made me actually kind of... people started recognizing my name was, like you mentioned, with 14 Degrees, and I got into a little bit of independent filmmaking. Just finished recently a John Zaffis film, Museum of the Paranormal, which people can buy now at museumoftheparanormalmovie.com. So that's the next big thing. But a lot of my work has, one of the things that some people don't really know about me, or at least, they don't really have realize what I've had going on in my life is that I'm a paranormal investigator, but more from a science point of view, a bit of a paranormal scientist. And I've started a group with Annette, my girlfriend, and which is NECAPS, New England Center for the Advancement of Paranormal Science. And the work that we do with this center is really trying to advance the scientific aspect of the field by doing geological correlation studies, advancement in equipment development. A lot of my history before the movie days was in biomedical electronics engineering and research and development. So I've taken that knowledge and applied it to developing new pieces of equipment. And a lot of the studies that we do with the group, NECAPS, is to develop databases and compare studies to find patterns and correlations in paranormal data. And so there's a lot of aspects going along with that. We work with groups all across the country. One of the groups we work with is in Maine, Prime Maine, and a lot of different groups that have become affiliates to help contribute to the data. And really, it's more of a unification, trying to unify paranormal groups from across the United States and even abroad, anybody who wants to contribute, to try to find answers scientifically of some of this phenomena that's been going on. So it really depends upon who you ask and who's seen what part of my life that on what I would be known for.
Well, yeah, I know.
That's amazing.
Just a moment ago, you told me you made a CD, and I didn't realize that about you. So maybe it's easier to ask you what haven't you done? Yes.
Well, yeah, the music aspect of my life actually was the precursor to the video aspect. I owned a music store for about a year. I repaired instruments for quite a while, and that's really what started it all out. I got into different bands, eventually got into cover bands and then wedding band. The wedding band, anybody who's ever been in a band knows that sometimes it can be hard to keep the members of the group together, and they just disband and go their own separate ways. And I got caught one particular time with an obligation to do a wedding, and the band had split up. And so I took some of the equipment, sold it, got DJ equipment, so I could fulfill the obligation to the wedding. And I started DJing weddings for a little while. Hauling the equipment around became cumbersome. It was very heavy, and it was you know, it wasn't the most glorious job in the world.
Yeah, we can relate to that.
I know all about that.
I traded it in and got a video camera.
I had
a lot in common.
I had a big idea of being a mobile DJ a couple of years ago, and the first gig I had, everything had to go up a weird flight of stairs, and then the next one was a husband that hired me for his wife's birthday party. He loved 60s classic country, and she liked 70s classic rock. So I'd play a classic rock song for her, and then he'd come up and say, "What are you playing that crap for? I paid you to play classic country." So I'd put on a classic country song, and she'd run up to me and go, "What are you playing that crap for? It's my birthday. I don't want to hear that." And this is how the whole evening went. And
well, that's how it goes.
And I promptly stopped doing mobile DJing right after that.
Well, you know, I got the same kind of treatment. I had people come up to me and say that if you don't play U2 songs the entire night, I'm going to beat the crap out of you.
Wow. Yeah.
And then they come in, they throw their coats on you like you're a coat rack and toss you a five like it's a tip. I mean, it got really to be a pain in the neck. I didn't enjoy it. And I always had an interest in photography.
And I can relate to the band thing, too. It's wicked hard to find anybody committed at all.
Definitely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The bands are hard to keep together.
Yeah, they are. So I promptly took my equipment and volunteered it at the local teen club doing sound and lights for unsigned pop rock bands that come into town. And that was a whole lot nicer. Anyways.
What's 14 degrees mean? What's the...
Yeah, we were debating that on the way down here. Where did the title 14 degrees come from? What's it mean?
Well, there's a little bit of a clue in the beginning. You'll hear a voice of one of the investigators that we had interviewed talking about a cold spot that he got, where it went from 85 degrees to 14 degrees right in the middle of it. And it was a 10-foot-wide cold spot in the middle of a cabin without any electricity, and it was in the middle of the summer. So 14 degrees was a hard temperature to achieve in the middle of that area. So it was on a wooden floor. It wasn't metal or concrete or anything. So I thought that was interesting. It had a strange story behind it, you know, and if you say the name 14 degrees or the word 14 degrees, people start to wonder, just like you did, but it has a bit of a story. It's a cold spot.
It sounds creepy.
Yeah, really. 14 degrees just has a creepy sound to it. Yeah.
But it was 10 feet
anyway,
wide.
What's, since we got plenty of time here, let's start with 14 degrees. What exactly is that documentary about? And all that good stuff.
Well, 14 Degrees is basically a documentary about the history and modern methods of paranormal investigation. And it starts out, it takes you from the earliest days all the way back 5,000 years ago to the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was the first paranormal story on reference. And it takes you through time, through the Greek period with Athenodorus Kananitis and up through the ages. The change, the turn of the century, the Fox sisters, you get into Thomas Edison, you get into Harry Price, and, you know, it just takes you through the period of that. And then once we get into the modern times, we start having interviews with modern-day paranormal investigators from multiple different groups, and they talk about the different aspects of it, from photography to sound recording, investigation techniques, how Hollywood has, you know, changed the field of paranormal investigation with the shows and movies that they come out with. And, you know, you go through different pieces of investigation periods and, you know, see different methods. So it's really more of a lot of groups that I know that have seen it, and they use it a bit of like training when they get a new member that doesn't really have a lot of experience in paranormal investigation. It's kind of an all-in-one where you can see everything in one movie, and it stays unbiased. So you're looking at people's opinions, not the opinion of me or the team that we used to put the film together. So it stays impartial, which is what it's actually earned a lot of points for me with the people that I've met, because you know how it can be when you give an opinion or you have something that differs with somebody else, they can get offended.
Yeah, speaking of giving opinion, do you think some of the shows, you mentioned Hollywood, do you think some of them are, you think they're... making it more than what it is?
Oh, yeah. I definitely do. I mean, I know several people that are in television shows currently. And the stories are always the same, how, you know, the media, the film crews that are there, they're trying to get what they want on as little a budget as possible. So, you know, there is some stories out that, you know, there are some film crews, and I'm not going to go into names because I don't want to bash anybody, but there are some that, you know, purportedly fake evidence or set up shots, and just because they don't want to wait another week full of investigations or even another night, which is costing them a lot of money with this entire film crew and equipment, and to put everybody up in hotels, they want to get it as quick as possible so they can have the next episode ready. So, and that's not everybody, but it is.
I think you can tell who does it and who doesn't.
Yeah. I think part of the problem is that ghosts don't belong to the union.
Yeah.
And they don't come out on cue when they're supposed to.
That's right. They're erratic. It's not on cue.
And you
can't have a television show that's focusing specifically on making advances without having the investment of time. You know, it's not a cooking show where you can have a half-hour show and end up with a nice dinner at the end of it. It takes time to do it, and it really, they don't see that focus. You know, there's definitely, it's almost like a generation gap in a sense, to be anomalous to it. I mean, you have a team that's looking for answers and looking for these breakthroughs, but you also have the film crew and the networks that are looking, they just want a show. So they can't appreciate completely the impact that could be had if they gave these groups the time and effort and energy and budget to be able to do what they were really put together to do.
Yeah, there was one show that that came out in the last few years, and I know I was totally blown away by the amount of evidence that they miraculously capture. Like, just put, you know, it's like, every other, they should be the envy of every other TV show out there, because
yeah,
it's like every week they've got this unbelievable
evidence. Well, they each have their own style, you know? Like,
it's crazy. But
I think I know the group that you're talking about in the show.
Are we allowed to mention it? No?
No, I wouldn't if I were you.
I don't want to specifically put anybody down publicly. I don't want to do that. But I think we, you know, anybody who's watched it or anybody who's into it can probably get the gist and has their own opinions of who's doing that. And you're right. And, I think if you look at almost any of them that are on TV now, almost any of them, you'll notice that they get evidence pretty much every show.
Yeah, I think the one from Pennsylvania U is really good. They're really good.
I know you can't hear it over on your end on the phone, Mike, but... I still got some clips from 14 Degrees here that I'm going to be playing as we go in and out of commercial breaks here tonight. And I guess unless you happen to be listening to the streaming on the net, you're not going to hear what's played, so you won't be able to really comment on them, I guess.
Well,
for some reason, when they wired this studio, they didn't wire it up so that the caller could hear anything but us. So,
well, if you let me know when it's happening, I can put a headphone up to my ear and listen along.
Yeah, well, it's basically, we got about 3 minutes here till we go to a commercial break, and we'll probably play one going in and one coming out. So, the last time you were here, you had performed a little experiment in the lab that I thought was rather intriguing, where you said you were able to recreate an EVP.
Oh, yeah, I want to.
But you said it took incredible wattage. Now, my son missed that conversation here, so maybe you can kind of just touch on that for a minute, what you did.
Yes, actually, it wasn't so much, it was recreating the physics behind an EVP, because, you know, I did a little bit of thinking, you know, at one period in time, we're wondering how these things are getting onto the recorder without anybody hearing them. Everybody has a bunch of different theories. It's radio waves, it's imprinted on the media, it's thought processes, all this stuff. But one thing I looked at was I noticed that the only thing that hadn't changed in the development or design of recording equipment over the years was the microphone. It's still inherently the same type of device. So I started looking at the microphones. You have three basic kinds. You have a condenser, dynamic, and electric condenser. And all of those are affected by electromagnetic fields in some form or fashion, dynamic being the most because it uses a magnet and electric coil. And the others are affected by electric fields, which are contained in the electromagnetic spectrum. And so I started applying electromagnetic fields, converting audio into electromagnetic fields and applying them to the microphone. And sure enough, I got full fidelity through the microphone onto the recorder. And I made this device that, in electronics, we have a thing that's known as maximum power transfer, which is when you have the matching impedance. And if you guys are in studio and music, you understand a little bit about impedance when you're dealing with speakers and such. And, you know, the maximum power transfer allowed me to have the most volume out of it. But the problem is, you know, I could take an MP3 or a recording or anything like that and transform it into electromagnetic energy. It would transform through the air, react to the microphone in the recorders, any kind of recorder, and it would show up in the recording. To get it to go 6 inches required 150 watts. To get it to go 2 feet, 3 feet, was 600 watts. So in order for somebody to fake this in or to trick somebody, they would need an awfully powerful amplifier somewhere. You'd notice where that would be, of course. And, you know, a million-watt amplifier to get it maybe to go into in the middle of a room, and that's just unlikely. So whatever these things are, whatever the voices are, they're local to the microphone, I believe, through my research. I think they're local to the microphone, and it's a pocket and a field of electromagnetic energy that is surrounding the microphone. And tying into that, I think a lot of the EMF spikes that people get on investigations are really just missed EVPs. You know, you have your meter, and it goes up, and it spikes up to 13 or 14, up into the 20s maybe.
That you should be recording.
And seems as though, to me, that could be a missed EVP, because when I measured the sound during the experiment, I took measurements of the electromagnetic field while I was working on the experiment, and it was similar to the spikes that you would normally get on a case.
Okay, so to put this in, to summarize this, number one, EVPs really can't be stray radio waves from public service vehicles or any of that stuff, because if they're just driving by on the street, they'd need like 10,000 watts in the car just to get it in there into the recorder that's in the middle of the building or something.
Well, not only that, you'd need to, you know, people have recorded EVPs out in the middle of wildernesses, you know, in the middle of wilderness, and if you heard an EVP that was a radio transmission, it would sound like a radio transmission, and it wouldn't be just a single word or a phrase. It would be, if it cut in and out, you would hear parts of a word, parts of a phrase. It would, if it was a radio station, a regular radio station, you'd hear bits of music. It would be a professional broadcaster's voice. It would be sound. There would be a lot more clues to symbolize that. Electronics have what's known as a floating ground, and that is what enables them to receive radio interference as a general design principle, but they also put a lot of features into the design of it to eliminate that. And, you know, they ground out any kind of stray radio interference. That's not to say that they can't get it, but it's the sounds that are being picked up are often whispers. Nobody broadcasts on the radio in whispers. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of inconsistencies to make this come from.
Well, just going back to what you said earlier, if it was a radio wave, you wouldn't necessarily hear people with professional radio voices, especially if they're taking the EVPs while we're on the air. But we know what you mean. And I guess the second thing to learn from that, we got to go into a commercial break here. The second thing to learn is what Al just said is. Always, whenever you're taking EMF readings, always be recording at the same time, I guess, is what pretty much what your study showed.
Yeah. That's just a hypothesis, of course.
Yep.
But that's my guess so far. It seems to be plausible that, you know, the spikes that you're getting may be electromagnetic transfer that's in the air. And it's just a missed EVP, possibly.
Have you had anyone else confirm your studies?
Well, I've repeated the experiment in front of, you know, at lectures and at conferences.
Okay.
And I've demonstrated it dozens and dozens of times. And I've taken measurements from it and tried different variations of it. And I've even reversed the process, so when I'm asking questions in an EVP session, I'm speaking in electromagnetic fields as well as audio, thinking that maybe if they're talking on this level, they're also hearing that way.
Yeah.
And so, because, you know, amazing. In order to have something listening to you, it's audio is a physical thing. You know, it's you need something to resonate like an eardrum. These things are not as physical as they once were. If they are indeed, you know, passed on, people that have passed on. So you need something, they're dealing with energy, and we're dealing with electromagnetic energy, trying to talk in the same language, you know. I don't know if, you know, I've tried this, I haven't gotten a lot of response, but of course I haven't tried that reverse process. I've only done that 3 or 4 times so far. I haven't brought it out into a lot of locations that are really big on EVP, EVP recording. So I still have more experimentation to do, but the principle of it does work. I can take any recorder and play a sound through it. You would never hear it, but yet it is picking up on your recorder, and you can't tell. The fidelity is the same. It sounds like somebody is in the room.
Hmm.
So it's a step, I think, in a direction to go with research, and that's what we've been doing with NECAPS, a lot of that kind of research and work.
Cool. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break here. We will be back with Michael J. Baker here in just a few minutes, so don't go anywhere.
Regardless of your religion, it's difficult to find any written reference in any religious doctrine that doesn't specifically describe or base its point on the belief of contact with a spirit or an afterlife existence. The bottom line is that there is incredible similarities in the stories, and yet no one on either side is willing to step forward and make a connection. The purpose of the Malleus Maleficarum was essentially to refute any and all arguments against the reality of witchcraft. The church at the time wanted the people to believe wholeheartedly that there were these evil creatures on the loose that would talk to Satan and steal your children, and that they were alive and present in society, and that they were a danger to everyone.
All right, that leads me to my next question. We're back here on Haunted America Radio with Michael J. Baker, and that was a clip from the paranormal documentary 14 Degrees. Let's see, how do I put this without getting myself in trouble? How much of religion is truth, and how much of it is church propaganda?
Well, you know, you look at that, that's a very dangerous and hot topic.
Yes, it is.
I think the thing about religion is it's, as everybody knows, it's a personal belief, and it's a matter of perspective. And so, to me, the best way to get anything out of a religion would be to see what it means to you and how it drives the person. As far as historical documentation, I mean, if we're looking at any religion, that there's only a very few religions, actually, that have direct documentation from events that had happened. If we're dealing with, for example, the Catholic religion, not a word was written about Christ until 75 years after his death. So we're talking about information that's been handed down from generation to generation. If you're looking at any story in terms of science, that's not as reliable as it could be. So we're dealing with something that, you know, in a religious state, you're dealing with something that is more important to how you interpret it and what it means to you and how you feel about it than something that is specifically science or something that is represented.
What do you think about the Shroud of Turin?
The Shroud of Turin is interesting. I mean, you know, the samples that they've taken, I know that a lot of the carbon dating on it, when they originally took it, they took it from the corner of the shroud, and it was turned out to be inaccurate because so many people have handled it there over the years, and they originally dated it back to 700 years. But from what I heard, they did another sample for more in the center of the shroud, which brought it back to the time of Christ, 2,000 years. But I, you know, it's like I don't know what to think of it. There's so little information to go on. All we have really is a story that was written in a book, in a collection of stories, actually, written by a bunch of different people over many, many years. And I don't know what to take of it. There's not enough information to go on. I suppose that's more of an archaeological aspect. I'm sure that the people that were mentioned in the books and the scriptures There are people who have existed and they played those roles in life. As far as the miracles go, and all of the divinity, you know, we take things and we look, we take it and we make of it what it means to us. It's what guides us.
No.
And, you know, back if you go back into, you know, prehistoric times, they were cavemen throwing rocks at the moon because they thought it was something, you know. Or you know, something, anything new like that. Lightning and thunder was thought to be, you know, an angry god, and all these different things that affected the way beings lived and people lived in the earth. So it's a difficult subject and it's a difficult question to answer because it really comes down to what you believe, you know, and what it means to you. If it's propaganda, the church is. I will say the church is. Guilty over the years, over the many, many years they've existed, of creating propaganda. The Book of Kings, for example, was written to control the unruly people of the time. So that does exist as well. How much fact is in the foundation of religion, though, is really up to what you want to make of it.
Yeah, well, that's what I was kind of referring to, because I know up through the centuries, the church was one of the most powerful political figures there was, and they did come up with certain rules and laws and things like that where they passed them and said, you must follow these because these are the word of God.
And yeah, they eventually controlled all of Rome.
When it was basically just a bunch of guys in a room purporting to talk for God instead, you know? So it... That's always been in the back of my mind, you know, just what trying to dig out the truth, the historical truth from the things that certain individuals have dreamt up over the years.
Well, not only that, but the intention of what was written.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of what you just described is it's not as intense, but it's still happening today. We see a lot, at least with the last you know, set of elections, presidential elections, we've seen a lot of influence. With religion. You know, there were a lot of candidates that were judged or picked whether they were worthy based upon their religious views or perspectives. And so it still does have an influence. And it's a powerful thing.
It all comes down to integrity, basically, all religions.
Yeah, but when you're 2,000 years into it, you don't know who to believe.
Yeah.
Well, that's just it. You know, that's why it's a faith.
I mean,
it's
not like you can look them in the eye, you know, when it was 2,000 years ago when it was founded, you know.
It's just a bunch of different recollections of the same story.
Well, the thing that's always been in the back of my mind is you know, what if there was a Stephen King of his day and sat down to write this sweeping novel, you know, that's the war and peace of its day or something, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, that's just it. The War of the Worlds with Orson Welles shows how people can take things out of context and get scared by them and believe them, you know, and it happens. It happens in society. It happens all the time. And, you know, just like the clip you played, you know, coming back in, the Malleus Maleficarum, I mean, look at that church doctrine did, that document did to life for so many hundreds of years, scaring the heck out of people, you know, and they were actually supporting the fact that there were flying witches and evil devil creatures that were running around trying to kill your kids. And, you know, do you believe that simply because the church says it? Or do you look at it in a different perspective and do you look at what's the plausibility of something like that existing? People put faith in the church and in their religion, and they follow it. And that can be dangerous, and it can be good.
Well, that was the whole point of Jesus, I think, was that we didn't need the church. We just need to follow love, you know?
Basically.
Love thy neighbor, that's it. And love thy God, you know?
Yeah.
It all comes down to those two things.
It's all from within the individual.
Yeah, you don't need the middleman. I don't believe you need the middleman, you know, the confession and all
that.
Yeah,
I think you're right. I think there's two aspects of it. There's organized religion, and then there's faith.
Yep.
And, you know, organized religion can be a very dangerous thing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know,
and I think
people follow it. And, you know, it's funny, you know, they talk about, but there's a lot of religious leaders that are very wealthy, very rich, and yet if they follow the scriptures, you know, if they were looking at the Second Testament, you know, where Jesus says it was easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to go into heaven, they're actually going against what was preached, and they're going against what they're actually teaching. Because
yeah,
because
I believe God wants you to be prosperous. He wants you to be rich. He wants you to be, to have a nice car, to have the,
to,
you know,
just so you can spread it around with other people and help other people
basically,
and stuff like that,
yeah.
You know?
But, well, it's funny. It's a very tricky subject because you're dealing with a belief system.
Well, just the way it's written, it's a lot of it's really open to interpretation one way or the other, you know?
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's one way or the other. It's impossible to prove either way. You can't prove a non-existence, which is what perpetuates the existence of many religions. I mean, you can't. I could tell you there's a chupacabra in my backyard, you know, but you could never prove that chupacabra doesn't exist. You may be able to prove it's not in my backyard, but you can't prove it doesn't exist. It's impossible to prove a negative.
Yeah, it's like Bigfoot. You know, prove to me there are not Bigfoots out there.
Right. That's exactly it. There's no way that you could ever prove it doesn't exist. So you're left in this catch-22 kind of thing, you know, and you leave the burden of proof up to the people that say it does exist to show me it does.
That's why there's tons of people on TV saying it does, but there's no one on TV saying there's no Bigfoot.
Yeah, whatever happened to that guy with the body in the refrigerator?
Oh, the Bigfoot?
The Bigfoot
body?
In the fridge, yeah.
Gorilla,
they're going to have a big
suit,
news
nice.
Conference and everything.
It was a gorilla suit.
Last I heard, they got fined $50,000, and they were, you know, it was a big hoax.
Yeah, well, I could see that coming a
Wasn't
mile
the
away.
Sheriff in on it too?
I don't know, but it was funny because they were, oh yeah, we're gonna have a news conference this Monday, and we're gonna announce it to the world. Okay, let's
right,
see.
And you know, that's what the psychology of that evidence. It's ridiculous. If you found a Bigfoot, would you wait to show it?
No.
Well, when you run out in the middle of the street carrying the thing,
yeah.
You know, look what I found, you know?
I mean, I know people here in Vermont that shoot bears, and after they shoot bears, they prop it up in the passenger seat of the car and ride around town with the arm hanging out.
As long as you're the first one to bring it out to the world, it doesn't matter when you do it.
Yeah, it would have been on some dude's trunk of his
Yeah, you have it on the hood or something tied down,
some dude's,
you know? He'd be driving through Walmart or something, you know?
He'd have a Bigfoot head on.
Town
his,
parade and everything.
Say, look, and that's not my sister. No.
Man, my bruncle.
Your bruncle, yeah. Oh boy. Uh-oh. All right, we got to do one more commercial break here, so we might as well get that out of the way. And then
stuff.
I want to ask you about kneecaps and all the other scientific.
Wait, what is kneecaps again?
You'll find out in a minute.
Okay.
We're going to find out what all this scientific stuff is, cool stuff you're doing here. So
stay tuned.
We will be back here in just a moment.
A lot of people, the first time they'll do it, if they're a little nervous about things, they'll just set it in a room and leave it and walk away and maybe go eat dinner or leave the house, go shopping or something. Then they'll come back and just listen. If you listen really close, you can hear it. Or you can hold it in your hand and ask specific questions, maybe even related to the building or the place you're at.
Hello, this is 911. What is your emergency?
Hello, 911, you've got to help me. There's a ghost in my trailer.
Excuse me, ma'am?
There's a ghost in my trailer. He's a flipping and a flopping and a flying all over.
Ma'am, please calm down. Ghosts do not haunt mobile homes.
Yes, they do. I saw it on hard copy.
Okay, what is the ghost doing?
He turned the lights on and off, and then he knocked on the door.
Are you sure it's not the power company?
No, he's right here on the couch eating Cheetos.
Okay, what does the ghost look like?
He's invisible. I can only see the orange stuff around his fingers and his mouth.
Sound familiar? This scenario happens every day at trailer parks across America. Experts estimate that one out of every six mobile homes is haunted by a ghost or perhaps a possum. You could be next. Here are some telltale signs. A can of skull mysteriously floats through the air. Blood drips out of your simulated wood paneling. The room is spinning and you're not even drunk yet. If you think your trailer may have an unwanted guest, please call Trailer Exterminators. We specialize in mobile home ghost removal as well as the extermination of aliens, secret government bugs, and in-laws. Don't call 911. Call us now.
Trailer Exterminators, may I help you?
Yeah, the government has built a tiny robotic inchworm that has infiltrated my compound in an attempt to steal my secret corn squeezing recipe.
Don't worry, sir. We'll be right over.
Oh, but hurry, because they're about to unleash a giant bat.
Don't delay. Call now. Double Wise Extra.
And we are back, Haunted America Radio, with Al and Al here on 1370 AM WBTN, and our special guest Michael J. Baker on the phone here, and we're having a good old time here. So, tell me about Kneecaps. I mean, that's a heck of a name, you know? It's like, you're part of the Boston Mafia or something, or what?
Is it the NICAP?
Only if they were broken, I mean, I don't know. No, it's Kneecaps, the acronym itself, we thought was kind of interesting. It kind of fell into place. But it stands for the New England Center for the Advancement of Paranormal Science, and that really is what the group does. We work for the advancement of paranormal work, paranormal science, and bring the studies of paranormal activity into a tangible, recordable scientific world, which I know a lot of groups have a scientific approach and scientific doctrine, but there's a lot of tedious work that we do that is helping to advance the field. And for example, one of the projects that we're working on, and we've been doing it now for, I'd say, going on a year, it's a geological correlation study where we're taking a survey of all of the paranormal active locations in the United States. So it's obviously a tremendously big task to do, putting them together in a large database and applying geocodes to them, latitude, longitude, and then comparing them against environmental and geological data, such as mineral deposits, gravity, gamma radiation, fault lines, mineral deposits, things like that. And we compare the data together to try to find patterns or to try to find, you know, things that happen to repeat to give us clues as to the areas of the country or areas or conditions that may help promote or to help perpetuate paranormal activity.
Now, wouldn't that only be for residual hauntings? Would that doesn't, are intelligent hauntings, like, separate from that?
Yeah, I guess what he's saying is intelligence hauntings just are that, intelligent. They can move around, they can follow you and everything else, where the residuals are in one spot standards. All the time.
It's like pressing play and record.
Well, you see, that's part of... Well, you see, the thing is, the study itself, we take all... The first phase of it is to create this database list. For example, in New York, now we have 100 locations. And the locations are placed into a KML file, so you can upload them into Google Earth. Each one location becomes a pinpoint where you move your mouse over it, and it tells you all about it, what's there. We do these overlay maps, etc. The data itself, after it's been placed in there, is going to be weighted in terms of whether it's legend or personal experience or there was evidence taken from it, and whether it was residual or considered to be residual, or repeated, or intelligent. From what I've found right now, in just some of the preliminary studies, and we don't have the full analysis of this yet, because we have to compare them state to state, and we're still building our databases, but it seems that geomagnetic energy is a key player in the locations of paranormal activity. In other words, if the geomagnetic energy level is too low, there is no paranormal activity. If it's too high, there is no paranormal activity. And that's, I've noticed the pattern repeat across three states so far. And obviously we need to build the database bigger to get a better sample. But, and this is intelligent or residual. Hmm. And what it comes down to, you know, everybody's in the field has talked about limestone, being a big player in a lot of poltergeist activity.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've seen so far, the activity in the locations occur alongside limestone, but not over limestone. And it's kind of interesting that from what I've seen so far, there's a lot of patterns coming out of this study, and there's a lot to look at. One thing that Annette, my girlfriend and partner in this, has noticed is that, and we have to verify this by creating a bigger database, but is that hauntings typically occur, at least from this one particular state, and they typically occur within a mile of a cemetery. Now, that was an initial notice. She noticed this from looking at maps. We're currently entering in the locations of every cemetery and every burial ground in each state to be able to do another overlay map and compare the locations together. There's also, some speculation. I know that Dr. Barry Taff, who's out, he used to work at UCLA, he actually made a claim that paranormal activity seems to follow UFO sightings. So when somebody sees a UFO and they report it, there's usually a paranormal occurrence in the same area directly following it. So I have, from the Newfort site, a KML file of all of the UFO sightings in the United States dating back all the way to the 1800s, which we can create an overlay and compare against the map that we're creating now. This map is the first of its kind. Nobody has ever created a paranormal map, and the reason being, I imagine, is because it is such a tremendously large project, and we're getting groups from all over the country to contribute data to it. And the data can come from anywhere. It can come from books, it can come from movies, come from, it can be a legend, it could be a personal experience, it could be something from your childhood, it could be something somebody told you. Right now, we want to create the data, then we will quantify it.
Now, how many hundreds of people on your staff do you have doing this?
Right now, the group itself offers two ways to do this. I mean, locally we have members, actual members of the team that work and do this type of data collection and analysis. But we also have groups that become affiliates of NECAPS, and they will be entering the data for their own states. And because obviously the group that's investigating Maine would be best to put in the data for Maine, because they know the most of the locations, and they will also know some of the areas. So as we build it up, I think we have 15 states in progress right now, and it's building more and more and more every day. The database is available for public view as it's being built, and if you go to NECAPS.org, NECAPS.org, you can log into the research page, and the data itself is free. We don't charge anybody to look at it, but you do have to request a login because we'd like to keep track of who is accessing it. And who is requesting to look at it? Because
it's the government. Because remember NECAPS, they're the ones that always used to help Mulder out in the X-Files.
Oh, really?
Remember?
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
You go and meet up with them. And
now, what do you put in here? Just spiritual ghost sightings, and you said mentioned UFOs.
Yeah.
Like Bigfoots and chupacabras and all this stuff too, or?
Well, no. Right now we're doing basically just paranormal activity, ghosts in a sense, which even though it may not be a ghost, it could be telekinetic, but whatever paranormal activity, we're not dealing with cryptozoology for this particular study yet, and the UFO aspect of it is only to compare against the data that we're collecting.
But you said you saw a correlation between the UFOs and the site and the ghosts.
Well, the other guy,
was it at
Barry
the exact
did.
Same times, usually, or...
Well,
did it differ?
Dr. Barry Taff is the one who made the claim of that, and we haven't. I've overlaid the map over one of the states, over New York, and I have seen some of the pinpoints match up, not all of them. Yeah. And so we need more data. We need a bigger database to compare against, because the UFO database is absolutely gigantic, and I don't think it's fair to present 100 pieces of data against one that may have 2,000-3,000.
Really are from outer space, and they bring us back to visit.
You could be, yeah. that would explain a lot.
What I feel
the,
is
the moron in me says you need to add a new field into your database, and that's vicinity to the current or to the nearest bar, which might explain a couple sightings.
Well, that's where that's what I say. That's why we need to quantify it. You know, we build the database, and there's a lot of different aspects of information that gets collected: the location, the time of day, was it indoors, outdoors, was it a personal experience or a legend, etc. Is it a public place or a private residence? Is it which equipment was affected? What was the readings on the equipment? How did it correlate? The notes that go along with it. I mean, there's a lot of information that we collect.
Time, hot, cold, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And, that's, you know, awesome. The database itself is available. Anybody can view it. You just log in and take a look at it. It's actually kind of interesting. And if you have a paranormal group in one of those states, it gives you an idea of what areas have been investigated. And, if you know, you can compare it against some of the other places that you've investigated and see if things are coming out of the woodwork as any kind of pattern. The second phase of it, like I said, we quantify it, and then we compare it against the geological data. The third phase is to create a new database with the findings from the geological data, and then it goes into a big, large database where we look for patterns. This is the final stage of it, and this is where the statistical information comes out. And through this type of research, we will be able to know for sure some of the stuff that people have made claims to all of these years without having any real justification to back it up. For example, you know, we would know what percentage of hauntings are apparitions, which ones contain actual evidence that come out of it, or which ones have shadow figures, which ones, you know, we'll be able to develop authentic statistics based on the information that comes in, and obviously the ones that are just legend don't have as much strength as the ones where people had personal experience and gathered evidence. So it's...
I was going to ask you that. If you're putting in... legends and stories out of books and stuff like that that haven't actually been investigated or not.
What was the question?
Yeah, if you were including, you know, legends and folklore, stories that come out of books that haven't actually been investigated, if you were including them in your database or not.
Yes. Oh, everything that is a story or legend at all is included. The data is treated as what it is. It's not obviously something that is a legend that was only, you know, this, you know, folklore tells us that this occurs every year, etc. That is not going to have as much weight in the statistics. And we're going to build statistics based on that. How much of this is legend? How much of this is personal experience? I want all of the information. I don't want to exclude anything. Because when you start excluding things, you start to skew your own data. So I want as much information as I can get, and then we'll sort it out on the other end. Because if it's marked as legend, or if it's marked as hearsay, or marked as whatever, we can sort the information by that and deal with the data the way it's supposed to be. Because we don't know. Maybe one of these legendary stories or these legends did have activity. Maybe it was based on facts. Maybe we don't know. And that's why it's such a gigantic study.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if you could, you know, validate a 100-year-old story after the fact.
Right.
We got about 50 seconds here. We got to go to the top of the hour news, and we can pick up this conversation on the other side here. And also, I want to hear about your new movie too. So we're going to get into that too as well.
Sounds good.
Yeah, this is Haunted America Radio with Al and Al here on 1370. AM, WBTN, and those listening on KnightRiderRadio.com on the internet. We're going to go to the top of the hour news here, and then we'll be back with Michael J. Baker, director of the paranormal documentary 14 Degrees, and a whole bunch of other things that you're finding out about here. So we will be back in just a momento.
You know, I go through these times where I believe in ghosts wholeheartedly. Something will happen to me on a weekend, and all that week I'm like, oh yeah, there's ghosts. And then by the next weekend or a couple weekends after that, I'm like, ah, well, maybe not. And then I'll go come back down to the mansion, or we'll do an investigation or something. And it's like, oh, yeah, there's ghosts. So it's like I go through these phases. It's tough. If you don't see it every day, then you start to rationalize everything that you witnessed or experienced in your head. And over the week, you can do a lot of rationalizing. And also, you forget evidence, too. You know, you forget that maybe this happened to you. So you're forgetting all about stuff that happened, and then just kind of reiterates every time you go to another place.
Got a long time to go, so hope we don't get hemorrhoids.
Are you really concerned about that?
This is Haunted America Radio with your host, Al Shepard Sr. and Al Shepard Jr. on 1370 AM WBTN. To discuss tonight's topics, please give us a call at 802-442-1010. That's 802-442-1010. And now, Haunted America Radio with Al and Al.
Yes, we are back on Haunted America Radio, 1370 AM WBTN. Hello to all the Sunday night listeners out there who have nothing better to do. And those on Knight Rider Radio, thanks to Hillbilly Tony out there and all his... listeners.
Hillbilly Tony.
Well, we invaded. She was doing a show a couple of weeks ago, and a bunch of us kind of just crashed his radio show. And while we were on there, we decided we're going to rename his show Hillbilly Radio. And me and Katie Beth sat down, and we wrote him a new theme song. She's putting it to music right now, and then we're going to present it to him. So we do have a lot of fun over there at Knight Rider Radio, that's for sure. Anyways, our guest is Michael J. Baker, who is here patiently sitting on the phone while I act like a moron once again. But like we've always said, proving any two monkeys can do a radio show, this is Al and Al. Okay, we were talking about kneecaps and how you can skin them now and then and then get them rug burned. And, so what other things, what other little scientific... goodies experiments is kneecap undertaking?
Well, to give you a quick rundown, one of the projects we're working on is a phonetic calculator for EVPs. We produce reports for our groups, for other groups that want an official scientific report of any EVP that they get that they feel is worthy of qualifying evidence. And so I do phonetic analysis of full spectrum analysis of EVPs and give frequency counts and any kind of anomalous occurrences in a report. Part of that is a phonetic analysis dealing with the first two formant lines in the spectrum of the EVP, which can determine vowels and consonants. And so those vowels and consonants can be used without even hearing the file to determine what is being said. It's the same way that voice recognition software works, you know, like Dragon Naturally Speaking, things like that. You can, or even your cell phone when you do voice dialing. It recognizes the first two formant lines in the spectrum. Wow. And so I'm putting together a calculator where a group would be able to enter in specific data points of their EVP files, and it will calculate what word is being said. So it will help eliminate a lot of the guesswork of, I think it says this, I think it says
yeah,
that.
Yeah, because I've got a few that...
I'll tell you, 99% of the EVPs I've heard, I'm going, what?
Yeah.
I don't hear it. You know, and of course, there's 10 people there that have all convinced themselves that this is what it's saying.
Yeah.
And right. And I'm like, I don't hear it.
And the funny thing is, if there was just a regular... member of the group just speaking there, you wouldn't really have much of a hard time hearing.
Like that show there where a couple of guys, they said that they did their investigation back in 2001, and people from a completely separate independent group were getting EVPs specifically asking for them by name to come back.
Yeah.
Because they were provoking them, and, yep. and then they went back and did their episode of, okay, we're back, what do you want?
So this sounds kind of neat. Could this also replace or supplement like a Frank's box or something
Ghost
like that?
Ghost box, I was just going to ask about that.
Well, no, the difference is, you know, you've Frank's box or Ghost box is just simply a radio frequency scanner
mm-hmm.
that scans up and down the frequency range and pulls words and phrases out of radio transmissions.
Well, I know a lot of times with those, when someone says they're saying something, I don't hear that either.
Right, I don't.
Maybe I'm just old and my ears are bad, but
that particular technology, I don't really get involved with. To me, that is very similar to a Ouija board or dowsing. Something that's more on the
one, the obelisk?
The obelisk, yeah. Well, the obelisk, interesting thing, I took that apart. It was sent to me to dissect by a group out in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I took it apart and I found out that there were no components in the entire thing that enabled it to do what they claimed it did. And it has two microprocessors. One of them stores up 500 words. And there's absolutely no way this device can measure temperature and EMF. There's no components in it to be able to do that. There's no Hall effect transistors. There's no coils. The only temperature sensing in it is a temperature sensor that's built into one of the microprocessors to alarm the unit in case it overheats. And a lot of the tests that I did, I put it in the freezer. I put it next to a power drill. All these excessive areas of high EMF and drastic temperature changes, and I couldn't get it to accurately respond because there are no components in this device built to measure temperature or EMF.
So basically you've got a chip with a database full of words and then another one which sounds like a random generator. So just randomly it'll say a word whenever it feels like it.
Right. There's four chips in the obelisk. There's one that is a text-to-speech creator. So it takes written words and changes it to a speech. There's an LM386 chip, which is a op-amp or power amplifier that will amplify it so you can hear it through the headphones when you plug them in. And then there are two microprocessors. One of the microprocessors controls the general functions where you can go through the different modes like EMF mode or dowsing mode or the regular mode. And the other chip, the other microprocessor, contains the 500-word database. Hooked up to that 500-word database chip are two stray wires that are hooked into two analog ports on the chip. They pick up random whatever's, not
that's
EMF.
That's the antenna.
Say again? It's like an antenna.
That's the antenna, right?
It's an antenna.
It's like an AM antenna.
Right, but you see, they make claims that this can be used as an EMF detector.
Well, they claim cell phones can be, too.
Right.
Just download our software. It immediately turns your cell phone into a ghost detector.
Well, the funny thing is, though, cell phones, because they can actually detect magnetic fields, where this device can't. And it only has two straight wires. In order for this to detect the EMF fields or even magnetic fields, it would need a coil of wire, and it doesn't have that. Or it would need a Hall effect transistor or some kind of device like that in order to detect it, and it doesn't have it. It also doesn't have any temperature sensing device other than the component that's built into the chip that senses the temperature of the chip in case it alarms. So it really is not a device designed to do what it claims.
No, about the ghost box.
So are you gonna invent it though? Are you gonna fix it and make your own version?
No, you see, I'm not one that really picks up on. I don't really care much for dowsing type of devices. I think I'm more of an environmental measurement kind of guy, and I like to find the impacts that these beings make on our physical environment, rather than hoping that they're pulling a word out of nowhere and spitting it through this box for me.
Now, there are a few episodes, though, where they came so, just the words were so relevant of what they were saying. Like they were saying, furnace fire. It kept saying that, and it sounded like he said, a scanner.
But you don't know how much of that
dogs,
is editing.
Dogs, and then
getting
the
back
dogs
to what,
ended up dying in the fire.
Getting back to what we said at the beginning,
yeah.
You know, there might have been a half an hour between the question and the answer. You just haven't seen the editing that went on.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. And you also have to take into account that these words were chosen. They're 500 words that were picked, hand-picked, And so if you could narrow down your communication to everybody in the world to just 500 words that you were only able to use, you would pick the most significant ones so they'd have the most impact.
Yeah, you're not going to include if and the but and all those things.
Or even a million other words that might not have it. If you're making a device that's geared towards paranormal research, you're going to pick words that are significant to paranormal research, such as murder and hurt and soldier and gun and battle, pain. And if you're out in a place where there is a history of this, these words are going to ring a bell.
Yeah, upstairs, downstairs, inside, outside.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So even if
there's going to be some relevance to it.
Yeah. I mean, even if they randomly hit, if you're inside and it says outside, you're going to go, oh, they want us to go outside.
Yeah, well, there's devices that, like, I don't know what they're called, but they like, supposedly, you set them in a room and it sends out energy, and then the ghost can use that to do whatever. Like, isn't that kind of the same thing
as the ghost box? The generator.
Yeah, there's devices, and, you know, that's an interesting experiment in itself, where there are ion generators and electromagnetic field generators to help supply the environment with enough energy, hoping that the entity may use it to manifest. And those types of experiments I could understand be having some validity, or at least worth trying. It's just, you know, I look at the Frank's boxes, the ghost boxes, the paranormal puck, the ovalis, those types of devices as more of a Ouija board type of
magic
approach.
8-ball.
The K2, everybody's big on the K2, and I'm working with PRI Maine now on some modifications to the K2, because the K2 is a working device. It does measure. It has all of the components to measure moving magnetic fields. And so it is a valid device. And, you know, one of the things we want it to be able to do, you know, is have more of a readout, have some kind of different features of it that will improve it, some improvements to the design. So we're working on that because I believe that is a valid device to use. It's just people have been using it, and it's easy to trick it, in other words, with radio signals and things. So we're trying to work out some of the kinks of it and release some sort of enhanced device.
Well, good. Let me know when you get those worked up, because I have two of them in my underwear drawer that I can have you modify.
I mean, they do work. They do what they're supposed to do. And, you know, they were designed as a safe limit meter. You know, they were designed as to deal with the safe limits of electromagnetic fields in homes. They weren't designed for ghost hunting.
Yeah, they're not really precise enough, I don't think.
Right. But. And with a little modification and some of the flaws in it fixed, which is what we're working on now, it can become a very good device.
Now, I've asked everybody that has any technical knowledge at all on this show your opinion of the Parabot.
Opinion of a what?
What?
The Parabot. You didn't.
I haven't heard of.
You didn't
Parabot.
Get to see that on.
No,
the,
I haven't.
It was on one of the ghosty shows. There was doing a live investigation, and this guy wheeled out the Parabot, which How do I describe this? It looks like Houdini's water torture cabinet, clear glass on all sides.
Yep.
It sits on wheels. It's powered by remote control. Inside it has multiple EMF generators and a remote control door. Now, basically, what the claim is that this thing will detect a ghost through the use of the EMF detectors, chase the thing down, capture it in the box, slam the door shut, and then you've captured it. It's it goes like 40 miles an hour. If you if you look on YouTube and do a search for Parabot, the video is on there, and you can actually watch this thing in action. And he's caught multiple ghosts with it so far.
You're kidding me.
Wow.
No, I am not kidding you at all. This was on live TV last year.
He caught them. How do they know they caught them? Do they have, like, what, thermal images of it, of something in the box, or?
Hey, I'm just telling you what was said here. I'm actually trying to bring it up on YouTube right now.
So So it's a ghost trap, essentially.
It's a ghost trap. Robert Bess, here you go, is the guy who invented it, and it was on Ghost Adventures Live 2009.
It's
called the Parabot. So I don't know what to tell you. Ghost catching Parabots right here. I'm going to let my son see the actual picture of this here, if I can get everything out of the way here. But
I've never heard of it.
I don't know if we can play this. Here, I'm going to play this for the listeners here. You can listen on your headphones.
Yesterday, today, and tomorrow's technology sitting right there in front of you. People do not quite understand the physics that's involved in actually capturing and containing a real ghost. And it's not always just the ghost that you contain. You sometimes run into the poltergeist or something else. You don't ever really know exactly what you're going to contain until it's in the chamber. But once it's inside, it's fully visible. It's fully visible because the magnetic field on the inside is so intense, it has no choice. Though their operation may only last for 30, 45 seconds, depending on how strong the energy field is.
Okay, the magnetic field inside this case is so intense, it actually makes ghosts visible.
So they're actually saying you can see it.
Once you've captured it, then it's in that high intensity field that it will actually show up. It makes it visible.
Now, why doesn't he have video of that if he's done it several times?
Hey, I'm just telling you. So anyone listening, go to YouTube.com, search for Parabot, P-A-R-A-B-O-T, or actually Ghost Catching Parabot is the official name of this little video here. And this thing will do 40 miles
now,
an hour.
Nick
so
and Zach of
so
Ghost
you want to be a fast
actually,
ghost.
They actually gave him credit.
Yeah,
there's got to be something to it then.
Oh, yeah, because everyone knows that they're... Never mind.
They're...
All right, back to
something.
Michael.
They're the ones I was talking about that they're being called out.
I don't know what you do with it. You call Ghostbusters. I don't
know.
Have
a pet. Make it your
pet. Yeah, I got a pet ghost in a case, you know.
You put it in the containment unit, you know, until the EPA comes and
yeah,
brings them out.
Yeah, it's a hazardous waste the spiritual containment unit, you know. You
put a ghost box next to it and have a conversation. Talk to it. Oh, man.
Oh,
they can tell you when it's hungry.
What do you feed it? Oh, no. All right. We got to take another commercial break here. We're getting out of hand again. And we'll be right back with Michael J. Baker here in just a minute.
We tend to try and use evidence that has other evidence to back it up. You know, for orbs, for instance, we generally, if we have just a single orb or even a lot of orbs, which is, you know, pretty indicative of dust. But if we just have one orb and that's the only thing in a picture and there's the only occurrence at that time, we probably will end up debunking it. We're not really passing it off as solid evidence. We like to be able to say, not only was there an orb in the picture at this time, but there was a personal experience taking place. There was EMF fluctuation. We captured an EVP in the room at the relative same time as the orb. In other words, we're not just relying on one piece of evidence. If we have two or three things happening at the same time, then we're more apt to really say this is paranormal opposed to just something that is naturally occurring.
And now, back to Haunted America Radio with Al and Al.
And you are back on Haunted America Radio with Al and Al here, 1370 AM WBTN. And streaming at WBTNAM.org as well as NightRiderRadio.com.
We were talking about the infamous
guy
in the sheet.
Michael J. Baker here talking about the Parabot, and then during the break.
The guy in the sheet.
Talking about the spirit at Eastern State on Ghost Hunters. So We kind of got off the track here with you and your phonetic calculator here. Want to get back onto that again?
Well, that's one of the projects we have as well. And there's also, we're big on building up databases, you know, for reference points of view. I have a database of EMF output of popular devices like televisions and refrigerators and such that, and all of this stuff can be seen at kneecaps.org. It's, you know, if you go out and you get a reading off of a, you know, you get an EMF reading and you're wondering if it's normal for the device that you're standing next to have this kind of a reading, you can look it up in the database and see how much at what distance it, EMF it should be giving off. And so you know whether it's normal or abnormal or what it might be.
Now, I've always heard that living underneath high tension wires will make you sterile.
Well, there was a big study.
How much actually comes off of those high tension lines?
A lot. Actually, there was a study done in the 70s, and there were regulations put in place that children who grew up within 600 feet of high tension wires were much, much more likely, about 80% more likely to develop leukemia. And so they started putting regulations in for new developments that they can't be built within certain certain states had adopted this, but houses can't be built within certain distance of high tension wires.
I was going to say because I can think of two right off the top of my head, double wides that are sitting right underneath high tension lines right now.
Yeah,
here
it
in Vermont,
depends upon the state as far as what the legal limits are, because it's still. You know, the funny thing about EMF and health, it's still a very debated subject. There's the government actually put out pamphlets and things and did studies about electromagnetic fields and the effects on the human body. And there are some people who say that it has no effect. And, you know, then you have the people like, you know, from the 80s, like Michael Persinger up in Canada who made the God helmet, which induced all sorts of paranormal activity by exposing the brain to electromagnetic fields. So this, it keeps going back and forth, and but I think that it's past a certain level. In fact, that's what we were talking earlier, how the K2 was made. It's really the safe limit meter to know what's safe as far as electromagnetic fields go.
So basically, it was designed as an electrical instrument just to walk through your house and check, outlets and devices and things like that. And
that's
so
correct.
You could realize in your own house, don't stand next to the microwave or something.
Right, and it just makes sense, really, that these types of fields, you shouldn't be exposing yourself to too much of anything. Too much of anything is bad. So I do think it has some legitimacy as how it can affect, because the electromagnetic fields are very powerful within a certain frequency range. I mean, we're bombarded every day with electromagnetic fields. Light is an electromagnetic field. Microwaves, X-rays, gamma rays, radio waves, those are all electromagnetic fields. It's just certain frequencies in excess can be dangerous.
I was going to say, people don't realize how many radio waves there are floating around out there. You figure every radio station that there is in the world is all sending something out at the same time, and you're walking through it every day.
Well, think about the 600 or 700 satellites that are orbiting the Earth, producing lots of electromagnetic waves and radio frequencies that we have talking. I mean, we're a cell phone society. We're talking on electromagnetic waves. We're talking right now through electromagnetic waves. It's a dangerous thing in excess, and I think it has some effect. And I think if you compare the lifestyle and the way people lived and the health of people today with people from an earlier day when there wasn't so much electromagnetic energy, you'll notice a difference in the health aspects of it. I mean, there's a lot of people having different problems and surges and cancers and certain kinds of problems.
What about hauntings? Do you think there were less hauntings back then?
I think it was less reported back then. I don't think people were as open to coming out and saying it as they are today. I think the media and television has brought it. One of the good things that media has brought out is that it's made it less scary to admit that something is going on in your house.
Well, I think he was wondering if the increase in electromagnetic fields in the last 100 years has sparked an increase in activity.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Well, you know, that's an interesting study all by itself. I guess, you know, the problem is, like I was saying with the geo study that we're doing, I mean, people have taken records for Bigfoot sightings over the years. They've taken records for UFO sightings, but nobody has really cataloged hauntings. So there's really no method of being able to compare reported hauntings from yesterday to today.
Yeah. Like you said, people were probably embarrassed and want to admit that they're seeing, you know, a shadow figure or something.
Get you locked up in the loony bin there.
Yeah.
Throw away the key back then.
Well, right. Because, you know, back then, if you said you saw a UFO or you saw a Bigfoot or you saw some animal, you could be just mistaken. But if you're saying that there's something in your house that's been throwing things around, and I mean, that's something that deals either that you're having an experience, or back then they would consider it some sort of mental disability. So it's a different kind of story to tell.
I got a question. What about demons? Do you believe in demons?
I don't have much. I like the subject of demons as far from a point of view of history, or from, you know, what type of demon lives in what level of hell. The stories and the legend of it, I think.
Kind of like Greek mythology.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do like that. I just, I don't know specifically. I'm actually looking for, I don't classify anything because I really don't have enough information to classify. So, you know, people, you know, say this particular haunting, ex-haunting, is a demon. There's really nothing that I can take from that to say, yes, it's a demon, because first we have to prove that paranormal, period, is a significant existence. And we don't have enough data or enough information to be able to put that in concrete before we start classifying it. It's kind of like saying that, it's kind of like classifying Bigfoot. You know, if first we have to prove that Bigfoot exists before we can find breeds of Bigfoot.
Yeah,
you know?
Really.
So we really need
the
to
Eastern Bigfoot and the Western Bigfoot. And
right. So, I mean, right now we're just seeing Bigfoot. We have to first identify and prove that it exists before we can separate them. And I think we need to do the same thing with hauntings. People are quick to classify them or call them demons or give them that kind of angle without really knowing.
I mean, that's
whether it's what it is to begin with.
That's the big argument Josh and I used to get into on the when the show was on the internet. I've always said all along there is no such thing as an expert in the field of the paranormal. Because no one knows what's right and wrong yet. So how can you be an expert of something where you don't even know if what you're doing is correct yet?
I agree.
So I guess my opinion is, what about these so-called demonologists? Are they just experts in the folklore of demons? Or, you know, the ones that reportedly are expert at getting rid of demons or whatever. I don't know if I go for that or not, you know?
It's funny you mention that because, you know, every demonologist that I've ever heard speak or I've spoken to personally, and they've talked about cases, I have never heard, and before I got into paranormal, I thought this should have been the case, but I've never heard them talk about what kind of demon was infesting the home, what the name was, where it came from, or have any kind of characteristics built up to be able to identify it.
Well, you can't repeat the name of a demon, right? That's why they can't talk about it.
Well, they can still give it a classification, that's what they say. But, you know, I haven't heard any of them really talk about specifically what kind of demon it is.
Now, isn't there a certain number, and there's only a certain number of them? There's not, like...
I don't know the mythology behind how many demons there are, actually. I guess it depends on whether you believe. Are
they fallen
angels,
like an original,
or what are they?
An original set that followed Lucifer, and they've all, you know, basically...
Well, Lucifer itself is a matter of debate, too. Does the devil exist, or is he simply the Catholic Church's boogeyman to keep everyone in line?
Well, exactly. I mean, it was Dante's Infernal Abyss, you know, that created hell, and, you know, all of those were developed out of that, and that wasn't until 300 years after Christ. I mean, Christ never talked about hell. You know, that was never part of it. That was never written in those scriptures. I mean, so...
No, he said where there... But he did... He mentions hell. He doesn't say hell. He says where there will be great weeping and gnashing of teeth, which...
Right, but not specifically in the classification that we've learned of later.
Yeah, there's no burning fire in... And eternal
the lake of fire is mentioned also.
Is it?
In the Bible, yeah.
But I don't think in any of the books of Christ's testimony. I think it was done in Revelations, I know, mentions a lot of that.
It actually says that he must go there himself and then return.
Well, I know a lot of the people so I've had here on the show, at least three of them I can think of, have all told me that there is seven different levels of heaven. And normally people, when they pass on, they wind up at the third level. The bottom two are what you would consider to be hell, but it's not anywhere near what you think it is. It's just not a nice place to be, but it's still a holding place until you come back and reincarnate back to go through another life to learn your lessons. So you can go to the next level the next time you
mentioned
pass
on. Revelations. So, the whole book is like, it sounds like a big acid trip.
But that's the part of the paranormal I'm interested in. I'm not specifically interested in who's haunting a house and why. I want to be like Sarah Estep with the AAEVP organization, you know, who spent 20 years simply sitting in an office with a voice recorder and supposedly talking to people who are already in heaven, describing to her what heaven is like and what they do over there. And how there's a group of scientists over there called Time Stream that are actually working on building a device to communicate back here with us. At the same time, we're working on devices trying to communicate with them. And that's the whole story that I believe her book was Voices of Eternity. And that was the whole story that really intrigues me. I want to talk to people that are already in heaven. What do you think, Michael?
Well, first I want to establish that there's something. I want to take it step one at a time. You know, I can't jump to the destination when I still am looking for the road.
You're still looking for the train station, huh?
Yeah, I mean, as far as making determinations of any, I'm an agnostic. You know, I was raised Catholic, and I went to a lot of the classes for the RCIA, which was the Roman Catholic Initiation for Adults, and I went through a lot of this. I read the Bible back and forth three or four times. I gave it a whole picture, and it just occurred to me, you know, everybody finds, just like water finds its level, you find what the things that fit your life for you personally. And I just can't, for me, being a scientist, I can't look at, if I focus myself on a specific destination, all of my research is going to be geared to force it into that destination, and I don't want that. In other words, going into a house when I'm investigating, I can't look at it as I'm looking for a ghost. I'm looking for explanations of unusual phenomena. And when I'm left with things that are not explainable by any conventional means, then that is the data that I collect to study to determine what it is I'm dealing with. And so I'm not one to focus on the goal. I'm looking at it as a day-by-day kind of aspect. And rather than looking at the distance and saying that you know, we're all going to end up in heaven, I want to find right now if there really is a doorway to get there, in other words. So that's my approach to it individually.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah.
As a scientist, you don't want to have a preconceived notion of what your investigation is going to end up as.
Right.
You just want to go down the road and see where it leads, you know?
The way I put it to a lot of people is paranormal investigation, to me, is not an art. You know, when somebody's going to make a statue, they have an image in their head, and they make the stone fit that image. I cannot do that with paranormal research or science, because then I am soiling my own investigation, and I'm forcing it into a direction where that is not true science. It's not an unbiased approach, too. And whatever it happens to turn out, if it turns out that, my initial beliefs or my thoughts were all wrong, I'm prepared for that to change my opinion and thoughts time after time based on what I find.
All right, we got to go to our last commercial break, and then we'll come back with the last segment and wrap up. I want to hear about your new movie and all your different websites and this and that and everything else you got going on here. So we will be back with Michael J. Baker here in just a moment. We'll be right back. We are back on Haunted America Radio here on 1370 AM WBTN. This 2 hours is going by fast here tonight. Got on the phone Michael J. Baker. Now, before we run out of time, I want to ask you about your this new movie here, Museum of the Paranormal, is it?
Yeah, that's actually with John Zaffis. It's he's the one he's hosting it, and it's based on the items and some of the things in his museum in Connecticut. There are some dramatizations and some historic stories behind some of them. And it's now available for purchase. You can get it at Amazon.com, or you can actually go to museumoftheparanormalmovie.com, and there will be a link on our kneecaps.org website for you to be able to purchase it. But it's we went down to Connecticut, the New Gravity Media film crew. We went down there and we filmed for a couple of weeks in John's museum, and we got together some interesting interviews and some stories about some of the stuff that he has down there. And that film is going to be played kind of a secondary premiere at Dragon Con in September, September 5th through, actually it's the 4th through the 6th in Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm going to be speaking down there, doing a couple of seminars on paranormal research, etc. But the film will be available for sale down there and for purchase. And it's an interesting story. You know, it talks about some of the history of some of the items that he has.
Can you mention some of the items? What are some of the things he has?
There's a crucifix that was used in satanic rituals that caused one particular person a lot of grief. He hung it on his wall and left the satanic cult, tried to get away from it, but he became possessed because of the evil spirits that were allegedly attached to that crucifix. It was defiled, and so they had to exorcise the gentleman twice in order to get him clear, and they took the cross off the wall to help prevent it from coming back and attacking him. There were a couple of clowns, little clown puppets, that actually collector's edition, that a woman bought at a, I believe it was a estate sale, or consignment shop, I can't remember specifically, but she bought it there, she brought it home, and she had this feeling of being watched. She'd hear voices, the doors would slam shut, lights would go on and off. And the funny thing is, these particular clowns, the two that he had, he went and collected the two from the woman because she had these problems, cured her problem, and he ended up with a set of five that came from the same consignment shop, all producing activity for different individuals who didn't know each other. So it was an interesting connection between the two.
Speaking of connections, do you I gotta ask, do you see any do you know what sleep hypnagogy is?
Yes.
Do you think there's any connection between that and possession?
Yeah, I mean, possession, yes, I do.
Because all right.
Possession is really possession, from what I've seen and from what I've heard from people that do that handle possession and exorcisms and things, it can be a variety of different things. The symptoms can manifest themselves a whole different way, a whole bunch of different ways. It depends upon what is infesting them. They can either go catatonic, they can go very angry, they can be very subdued, they can have just sicknesses that haunt them, be very ill. And it depends upon it. It depends upon what is infesting them.
Al suffers from it. That's why he's asking. So.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that,
Well, you had mentioned shadow figures earlier in the show, and, like, when it happens, there's always one standing in the room, and it feels like it wants me dead. Like,
and you're what, paralyzed?
Completely paralyzed, can't speak, can't move, but I'm wide awake, I can...
That what you're describing there too, that was once called Old Hag.
Yeah, that's how it started. It felt like I just had something on my chest. And then there was more than a year between the first and second time it happened. And it just felt like a dark shape or a pressure on my chest. And then eventually one night it got up and it was a human figure, and that it's been going on for about 10 years.
What happens is, you know, when you're sleeping, there's a chemical in your brain that's released to stop the physical motion of your body. It actually paralyzes you, and it's done as a protection method.
Serotonin or whatever the heck it's called?
Well, it's to keep you from running in your sleep. You know, if you're dreaming of fighting somebody, you're not, your muscles aren't going to react to the impressions of your brain, and you're not going to start punching whoever's in the bed next to you. So, but what happens is sometimes people wake up, and this chemical has not been, it's not been called off. So you wake up in a paralyzed state. Your body's not able to move, and you're still in somewhat of a dream state. So you're going to see some things, and some odd things are going to make sense to you, and your imagination's going to play a part, and you're not going to be able to move. And a lot of people used to think that it was an old hag, a woman, that would come and attack you in the middle of the night and sit on your chest. And
it almost feels like my body, my soul's left my body, and it feels like there's like this battle going on, like this thing's trying to get in before my soul gets back. You know, I don't
obviously
know.
It didn't look you over very close, or it would have went and found somebody else's.
Well, this is that particular symptom. It's more of a sleep disorder than it is anything else. And you'll find that if you can find a way to relax or to, you may have some trouble sleeping.
It happens while I'm awake, though. I'm not even sleeping. It's not like I come out of a sleep. Like I lay down, and it always starts with a noise. Like I'm watching TV, and I'll hear a noise. Like a loud bang, and as soon if I just sit there and I ignore the noise, nothing will happen. As soon as I go to get up, I feel this pins and needles sensation, and that's when I'm paralyzed. So if I don't fight it, it just goes away. But I'm wide awake.
The pins and needles is kind of significant to a neurological symptom.
Yeah,
you may want to ask your doctor about that.
We've done. There's nothing medically wrong. Done MRIs. Okay. Done. The sleep studies.
Maybe we need to.
My first guess was that would be that I don't think you're possessed. Yep. I don't think that has much to do with possession.
Okay.
If it's something paranormal, that may be something different. But
maybe we need to put you in John's museum.
Maybe. Well, that doctor, the Native American one that I saw, she believed it was. Said they're all over. They've got these shadow figures in all cultures and everything. And
you ask 100 different people, you're going to get 100 different answers, depending what culture they're
from. She thinks
it's
something spiritual taking advantage of an already existing neurological something.
Maybe it's a combination of the two.
Yeah. It's pretty scary, though.
Just want people to know that now everything in... Is it everything in John Zaffis' museum actually came from actual... investigations where the people said, get this thing out of my house?
Not all of them came from investigations. Some of them were, there are times that he has things just dropped off on his doorstep.
Okay, word's getting around now.
Yeah, after the period of time, just kind of, it started out with investigations where he would remove something that people were afraid of and he would have it cleared and put it in a barn in the back of his house and he'd keep them there, and then he'd eventually move it into the house after he felt it was cleared. But every now and then he'd find things on his doorstep, or, he sometimes will even actively go out and look for things. If somebody's posting something that they think they have, I have this organ or piano that I need to get out of my house, or, and because it's having this issue, they'll post something online, and he may actively even go get it. They all come from different areas, and most of the stuff... is from donations and from investigations, but sometimes he'll actually actively go out and get stuff to keep it off the streets, according to him.
Go to the paranormal tag sale or something.
Yeah.
Flea market. Right.
Like their guns or weapons or something. That'll keep them away from kids.
All right. We got about 7 minutes left here. What haven't we covered that you are into?
Kids don't kill kids. Clown dolls do.
Well, as far as like you just mentioned with kids, I just want to mention a couple of things that we have on the NECAPS website. There's an area on there for children, for parents to talk to, teach parents how to talk to their children who are making claims that they're seeing things in their room and such, and there's areas on the site to help. There's also, we have an arcade up on the website. Anybody who wants to play paranormal-related video games, there's a whole selection of them up there. Some of them are pretty fun. There's actually one that my particular favorite and deals with these UFOs who keep pulling cows up, and you have to prevent the UFOs from stealing your cows.
That's awesome.
Cow tipping.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. We have a couple charities up there to benefit the Ronald McDonald House, where you can actually make a donation of $2 and we'll put a candle up on the site for somebody in memory, and the money goes to help the children at the Ronald McDonald House. And obviously it's not limited to $2, but it starts with a $2 donation. And we're going to be at Dragon Con, like I mentioned, in September. And I'm going to be, we don't have the specifics for the convention yet, but I'm going to be speaking at the convention that's being developed in Fort William Henry in New York coming up in October.
Hmm.
So you need to let me know about that, since it's only a half an hour away from here.
I'll have to write that down.
I didn't even hear
about it. All of this information you can find at kneecaps.org.
That wouldn't have anything to do with Scotty Roberts, would it, seeing that seems to be his favorite place to hang out over here.
No, this is actually, it's through Ideal Events.
Ideal Events, okay.
Yeah, they're putting it together.
I'm going to have to get a hold of him, seeing his mailing address is right here in Bennington, but yet I've never seemed to run into him. To Mark.
Yeah, he must sneak in at night and get his mail, huh?
Yeah, I don't understand. He lives in what, North Adams? But he had his mailing address on his website is here in Bennington. So
yeah.
I don't get it. But
I don't know. He's a mysterious guy. I don't know.
Guess he's in the right business dealing with the paranormal people here.
That's right. That's right.
But right. Yeah, make sure you write that down, Al. We got to go to that.
So anyway, it got. I asked you about the connection between the two, and you said yes at first. So what connection do you see?
Well, I'm just what my yes came from is that the connection, possession can occur in a whole bunch of different ways. It can occur from just being nauseous all the time. It can occur from the people that I've spoken to and from the things that I've done research on. It can occur in a variety of different ways. So, you know, you could have hiccups, and that could be there's people that may consider that a form of possession, and the hiccups can go away after exorcism. It can be as mundane as that or as dramatic as that catatonic speaking in tongues, and growling, voice-changing kind of Linda Blair-ish kind of look, milky white eyes.
She looks that way today, too.
It's... What you're describing, I mean, from talking to you, it doesn't seem as though, you have any other symptoms that go along with it. But
there's humming. There's humming, and there's
But you're not puking, and you're not doing the backwards crab walk up the stairs or anything like that. So let it get a little worse, and then we can videotape you, and we'll put you on TV and make all kinds of money.
Okay.
If you're concerned about it, I mean, you may want to speak to somebody that does take a deeper look into it. Like I said, I'm not a demonologist, and the demonologists that I've spoken to, they handle it in a different way. They work with different religious faculties and things to investigate it and determine whether it actually is a possession. If you've went through the doctor route and nobody can seem to find any answer, it may be something to ask and give it a try, because you don't have a whole lot to lose by having that looked at.
I've been trying to get...
The symptoms of what you have, yes, can be a part of possession, but then so can, like I said, hiccups. can be manifested as a possession.
Okay, thank you.
So you might want to take a deeper look at it.
I've been trying to get, what's his name? Is it Paul Tate? Is that his name? The Soul Smack Productions or whatever out of Maine. They did that whole thing on sleep hypnagogia and... can't even think of the name of it now. Nightmare or something was the name of the DVD. But.
Oh, yeah, Your Worst Nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. I've been trying to get him on here, but he won't answer any of my messages. all right, so you're going to be at Fort William Henry in October.
Yep.
What else you got on the horizon?
Well, we've got, there's several radio show appearances and such, which you can find about all of the events on kneecaps.org under events. Which this particular one's listed there.
Thank you.
And, we're gearing up to go to Dragon Con, which, anybody who's ever been there or heard of it, it's a pretty big event, and 50,000 people go within a few days. So we've been kind of pushing towards that. I'm also working on some equipment modifications. I have a few devices, a couple of them patent pending, that we're working on, which is a digital audio intensity monitor to determine the direction of sound and such, and all of those are also listed on the site under the research and projects. And, it's pretty exciting. Most of the time that I'm spending now is more for research and getting all of the studies underway.
All righty. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show with us tonight.
I appreciate you having me back.
I think it's been a year since you were on the last time. Been too long here, so we're going to have to get you back quicker than that. All right, we're just about done here. Don't you go away on me and chat with you after the show here. Let's see. Coming up next week, we don't have a show because the Boston Red Sox aren't starting till 7:30. And they are you better watch out. Michael's from Boston area.
Well, my girlfriend's from New York.
That'll be interesting.
So he better watch out.
But anyways, we won't have a show next week because of the Red Sox game starting at 7:30. And the week after, on the 15th, we're going to have psychic medium Gemini Rose, who was actually my guest co-host way back when, and she's always a lot of fun. And that show will be starting late at 8 o'clock because of another Red Sox game. So the next time we'll be back here is the 15th
at 8
p.m. Yes, she's actually going to give a reading to you and I so we can figure out what's wrong with us. So with that said, we're going to get out of here. We got the news coming up here in just a minute, or actually about 10 seconds. So we appreciate everyone listening here on 1370 WBTN and also on Knight Rider Radio. And we will see you all next week.
Bye.